In the morning, when Fat Tour came to my apartment, I was fully dressed and waiting for him. My strength and determination had been bolstered, and I felt supremely confident. I walked through the halls and passages of the palace with such a light and eager step that Lord Remrem, Fat Tour, and the rest of my entourage had to hurry to keep up with me. Nimrod's throne was empty when we entered the council chamber. However, the room was filled with his councillors and military commanders. They stood to welcome me to the long table, and shortly after we had taken our seats, the trumpeters outside the main doors sounded a fanfare. King Nimrod paced into the room in solemn state. My first thought when I saw him this early in the day was that he had foregone his cream-skimming and cherry-picking in the Temple of Ishtar to be with us. I was conscious of the respect with which he was according me, and this reinforced my confidence in what I was about to do. We went through the observation of royal protocol, and then I came to my feet and addressed the king directly. "Your Majesty, I have a proposal which is so sensitive and confidential that I would like to restrict it to your royal person, and to that of your single most trusted confidant. I give you my assurance that my offer will be very much to our mutual benefit, and will go a long way towards resolving the predicament in which we find ourselves at this moment." Nimrod was clearly taken aback, and for a while he tried to avoid making a decision. But I would not countenance an alternative, and at last he yielded to my urgings. I kept Lord Remrem at my right hand, and Fat Tour at my left to translate. Nimrod gestured at Admiral Alorus to remain at the table. Then he dismissed the rest of his staff. When only the five of us remained in the chamber, I removed the hawk seal from the sleeve of my robe and placed it on the table between us. "I am sure that Your Majesty is aware of the significance of this token.
Although this is the first time I have actually laid eyes upon it, I understand that this is the hawk seal which confirms that you speak with the voice and authority of Pharaoh Tammuz of Egypt."
"That is correct, Majesty." King Nimrod fastened his cold, dark eyes upon me. He said nothing more, but waited with the intensity of a leopard at the waterhole, sensing the approach of its prey. I regarded him every bit as intently. "Your Majesty, you and I both are battle-tempered warriors, with the experience and wisdom to know that wars are won not only with a gallant spirit and a keen blade, but also with the weight of silver we are able to hurl against the foe. I have never heard it expressed in those terms before, but they are wise words you speak, and infused with the truth." Nimrod spoke quietly. "In the name of Pharaoh Tammuz of Egypt, and by the authority of the hawk seal which I bear, I offer you silver to the weight and value of 30 lakhs on the single condition that you enter into a military alliance with Egypt and that you employ this bounty exclusively on the destruction of King Gorab and his Hyksos horde." I heard Remrem draw breath sharply beside me. He knew that I did not have Pharaoh's sanction for this offer, and he realized what a risk I was taking. But I did not deign to glance at him. Nimrod rocked back in his throne, and he stared at me in silent disbelief. I saw a rash of tiny sweat drops ooze from the skin of his forehead, beneath the rim of his crown. When at last he spoke, his voice was hoarse with incredulity and avarice.
"Does your Pharaoh indeed have a sum of that magnitude to dispose of?"
"I give you my assurance that he does, Your Majesty. I have been commanded by Pharaoh to seal the accord of our two nations by immediately delivering into Your Majesty's hand the sum of 3 lakhs of silver. This is merely a pledge of what is to follow." For a long while, Nimrod stared at me in silence. Then suddenly he sprang to his feet and began pacing rapidly back and forth across the floor of the chamber. His face was creased into a murderous scowl, and he chewed his lip until a drop of blood dripped from his chin onto his embroidered tunic. He exhibited no sign of pain. Suddenly he stopped in front of me and glared into my face.
3 lakhs immediately, and 27 more to follow within the year,"
he demanded. I waited for Fat Tour to make the translation before I agreed.
Even as your Majesty says, however, you must send a regiment of your finest to take delivery of the balance of the treasure in Thebes. Pharaoh will not accept the risk of transporting it with his own men.
Nimrod spun round and resumed his pacing. His bronze-soled sandals rang on the paving slabs as he stamped up and down the chamber. He began to argue with himself in Sumerian.
How can I trust this devious and ballless freak? It is no secret that he is in league with Seth and all the dark devils. There are even those who believe that he himself is one of the darker spirits from beyond the void,
he muttered, and then, when he realized what he had said, he spun around and shouted at Fat Tour,
"Translate my words at your peril. If you do, I will throttle you with your own intestines. Do you understand?"
Fat Tour paled and dropped his gaze.
"As your Majesty commands," he acquiesced.
Nimrod resumed his march up and down the chamber, and his argument with himself. Then he stopped in front of me again.
"Tell him I trust him," he ordered Fat Tour, "but that I must have a binding covenant with Pharaoh Tammuz of Egypt before I can agree to an alliance."
As he stated this condition, I saw the flare of lascivious guile in his eyes. "If it is at all possible, I know the Pharaoh will accede," I hedged cautiously.
"I wish to unite my family with the royal family of Egypt," Nimrod stated. "I wish to take Pharaoh's two sisters, Tahuti and Bekatha, to be my wives. In that way, Pharaoh and I will become brothers-in-law."
I was amazed at the extent of his greed, gall, and randiness. This rogue wanted both the money and the meat. "It is a great honour you are offering to bestow on Egypt. In any other circumstances, I know my Pharaoh would not hesitate a moment before agreeing with your suggestion." In a reasonable tone of voice, I concealed my anger from this obnoxious creature, who had heaped insults on me, and who now was blatantly lusting after my beloved girls. "However, Pharaoh has already pledged both his sisters in marriage to the supreme Minos of Crete, to seal the military alliance between our two nations. He dare not renege on this promise. The Minoan would not accept the insult to his honour." Nimrod shrugged and muttered something obscene. However, I could tell he was not too seriously irked by my refusal. Both of us knew that it had been an opportunistic attempt on his part to wring the last possible advantage from our agreement. No matter how much some men are offered, they will always try for a little more. Nimrod took another turn around the chamber while he rallied his wits, and then he made the next attempt.
"I would enjoy the sight of the three larks of silver you spoke of earlier. By no means because I do not trust you and your Pharaoh to honour your agreement, but merely because I am interested to see how you concealed them until now."
Nimrod addressed me directly, hoping, I am sure, to trick me into betraying the fact that I understood Sumerian. I frustrated him once again by looking to Fat Tour for translation. I was beginning to enjoy circumventing Nimrod's snares. It was not dissimilar to playing the Bao Stones against Lord Arton. I sent Zaras and Hui to fetch the silver from our regimental camp beyond the city walls. It took 2 wagons and 50 men to make the transfer. It was an impressive pile of bullion when it was finally heaped on the floor of the council chamber. Nimrod walked around the glittering pile, fondling every ingot, speaking endearments to them as though they were his beloved pets. That evening we feasted once more at Nimrod's board. I found the wine to be eminently more drinkable than the gutrot he had served us previously. However, its effect on the manners and behaviour of my host and his minions was less meritorious. King Nimrod had missed his morning exertions in the Temple of Ishtar. Agreeable or not, we were treated to an exhibition of the mighty hunter's insatiability. Half the females in the banquet hall ended the evening in a state of prurient abandon. I was pleased that I had left my 2 princesses locked in their apartment with Zaras and 12 of his men standing guard at their door. The 6 war galleys that I had purchased from Nimrod were undergoing a refit in Sidon Harbour and would not be ready for me to take command of them until the end of the month of Famenoth. I employed this hiatus to work with King Nimrod and his staff in planning our combined campaign against the Hyksos. I had selected Lord Remren to remain in Babylon and act as Pharaoh's military attaché. Reluctantly, I had agreed that Colonel Hui would stay with Remrem as his assistant. Under my tutelage, Hui had developed into one of the most skilled protagonists of the science of chariot warfare. I knew I would miss him and his expertise sorely when we opened hostilities with the Hyksos hordes in northern Egypt, along the coast of the Middle Sea. But Becatha had made her aversion for him manifest. I knew that she would cause a furore if I took Hui with us to Crete. Within weeks of Nimrod receiving the silver incentive, the workshops of his army were fully employed with the manufacture of new armour and weapons, repairing old chariots and building hundreds more to my own superior design and specifications. The streets of Babylon became crowded with marching columns of recruits, and the souks were tumultuous with haggling buyers and sellers. Through Fat Tur and his agents, I learned that every other city in Samaria was enjoying this same martial resuscitation. By the thousands, the formerly unemployed warriors of Samaria were flocking back to the royal standard and the king's silver coin. The work I had set myself was difficult and complicated enough, without me making it worse by pretending not to be fluent in the Sumerian language. I began to speak in a halting and childlike Sumerian to my hosts, which daily became more fluent and grammatically correct. Even His Majesty King Nimrod was forced in my presence to cease his insulting remarks about me to his sycophants. Soon I was able to baffle our hosts with my quick banter and my clever puns and play on their own language. One morning I watched Admiral Ararus on the far side of the chariot drilling ground remark to Nimrod that my rapid acquisition of the Sumerian language was nothing short of miraculous. When I crossed the wide ground to thank him for the compliment, Ararus shrank away from me in superstitious awe, and he made a sign against the evil eye. I don't think he had ever heard of lip-reading, but of course he believed in witchcraft, as does every educated and sensible person. In the cool of the afternoons, I took the opportunity to swim in the Euphrates or ride through the southern hills beyond the city limits, with my princesses for company. It amused me how often we encountered Zaras on our forays to even the most remote locations. It was almost as though somebody had alerted him to our coming. Of course, it could not have been Tehuti. Her astonishment at finding him loitering beside the trail almost superseded my own. In the evenings, there were always invitations to dine with our Sumerian hosts or with my own officers. If King Nimrod were present, I insisted that my princesses sat close to me, where I could watch over them. When most of the others had retired, I sat alone on the terrace outside my apartment, waiting until long after midnight for the return of the hooded lady. Night after night, she disappointed me. With all this bustling employment, the days rolled by swiftly. Then a messenger arrived from the naval base at Sidon with news that the 6 war galleys I had purchased from Nimrod would be ready for launching 20 days earlier than anticipated. It would take our cumbersome caravan almost half that long to reach Sidon on the coast of the Middle Sea. I ordered Zaras and Hui to make the final preparations for departure from Babylon to the coast. That evening, after I had escorted my princesses to their royal quarters in the eastern wing of the palace, I returned to my own apartment before the moon had set. My slaves had left oil lamps burning in my chamber and on the terrace beside my cot. According to my instructions, they had mixed the oil in the lamps with herbs, whose fumes drove off the mosquitoes and other nocturnal insects, but at the same time induced restful sleep and agreeable dreams. Orusti was waiting up to see me to bed. He came to take away my worn garments
and place a silver chalice of wine beside my cot. "It's long after midnight, Master," he reprimanded me. "You have not slept more than a few hours since the beginning of the week." Rusty had been my slave for so many years that both of us have lost count. Long ago, he granted himself license to treat me as though he were my nursemaid. With his help, I divested myself of my clothing and then went out onto the terrace and took up the wine chalice. I wet my lips and sighed with contentment. It was a 10-year-old vintage from my own vineyards on the Mekia estate. Then I turned to look across at the terrace of the temple of the goddess. I was disappointed, but resigned to find that it was deserted. It was weeks since I had last had a glimpse of the hooded lady. I dismissed Rusty and sent him still grumbling on his way, and then I paced the marble slabs, going over in my mind the salient points of the negotiations that I had held with the king that evening. Abruptly I paused in mid-stride. The quality of the moonlight had changed, taking on a subtle, golden luminosity. I looked up at the moon. I knew at once that there were preternatural forces at play, but I could not immediately ascertain whether they were benign or malignant. I made the sign of Horus with two fingers to avert evil, and I waited quietly for the mystic forces to declare themselves. Gradually, I became aware of a subtle and elusive aroma on the warm night air. I had smelled nothing quite like it before, but although I could not place it, all my senses were aroused. I felt an unusual but agreeable sensation building up in my neck and shoulders and running down my spine. This alerted me to the powerful presence close behind me. I turned to face it, and I was so startled that I dropped the wine chalice, and it rang on the paving. For a moment my heart stilled in my breast, and then began to thump again like the hoofbeats of a runaway horse. The mysterious lady from the temple stood before me, so close that I could make out her exquisite features in the shadows beneath the hood. If I had reached out, I could have touched her, but I could not move. At last I found my voice, but when I spoke, it was hushed with veneration. "Who are you?"
"My name is Inanna."
I was struck to the very quick of my being by both the sound and sense of her reply. It resonated in my ears like celestial music. I knew at once that no sound so beautiful could ever issue from a human mouth. The sense of what she had said was even more striking. Inanna was the ancient name, from the very beginning of time, for the goddess Ishtar. "My name is Taita." It was the only reply that I could think of.
"Apart from your name, you know very little about yourself, do you? You do not even know the name of your father or your mother."
She smiled in gentle sympathy as she said it. "No, I never knew them." I acknowledged the truth of her statement. Compassionately, she held out one hand to me, and without hesitation I took it. Immediately I felt the heat and strength from it flowing into me.
"Do not be afraid, Taita. I am your friend, and more than your friend."
"I am not afraid of you, Inanna." She held out her other hand, and when I took that one also, I knew that a powerful bond of blood and mind existed between us. "I know you," I exclaimed in wonder. "I feel that I have known you from the very beginning. Tell me who you are."
"I have not come to tell you about myself. I have come to tell you about yourself. Come with me, Taita."
Still holding both my hands, she moved backwards, leading me from the open terrace into my own bedchamber. Her footsteps, if there were any, made no sound. There was only the soft swishing of her skirts. I sensed that under them her feet were not touching the ground, and that she was suspended just above the surface. The beautiful, lantern-lit room that we entered had been my home for all these past weeks, and I thought that I knew every inch of it. But now I saw that there was a door in the facing wall
that I had never noticed before. As Inanna led me towards it, the door swung open of its own accord. There was utter darkness beyond the portals. Still holding hands, we plunged into the darkness and it engulfed us. We plummeted downwards, but she held my hands and I was unafraid. The wind of our descent blew into my face with such force that I had to slit my eyes against it. We flew in darkness for what seemed an eternity, but I knew time was an illusion. Then I felt solid footing beneath me, and we were no longer moving. There was light, at first only a glimmering. I could make out the shape of Inanna's head again, and then slowly her bodily form appeared beneath it. I saw that now she was as naked as I was. I have seen the bodies of many beautiful women during my long life, but Inanna far surpassed any of them. Her hips were voluptuous, but above them her narrow waist emphasized their elegant contours. Although she was as tall as I am, her limbs were so delicately smooth and sculptured that I could not prevent myself reaching out to stroke them. Lightly I ran my fingers up her arms, from her wrists to the curve of her shoulders. Her skin was silken, but the muscles beneath it were adamantine. Her hair was piled high, but when she shook her head, it came cascading down in a glowing wave over her shoulders and fell as far as her knees. This rippling curtain did not cover her breasts, which thrust their way through it like living creatures. They were perfect rounds, white as mare's milk, and tipped with ruby nipples that puckered as my gaze passed over them. Her body was hairless. Her pudenda were also entirely devoid of hair. The tips of her inner lips protruded shyly from the vertical cleft. The sweet dew of feminine arousal glistened upon them. The light grew stronger still, and I realized that we were standing in the hanging gardens high above the city of Babylon. The masses of shrubbery and flowers that surrounded us were wondrously lovely, but they were rendered mundane by Inanna's beauty. She took my hands from her shoulders, and she kissed them, one after the other. I shivered at the sensation that pervaded my whole being. "What do you want of me, Inanna?" It did not sound like my own voice that said it. "I propose to unite with you." "Surely you know that I am not a whole man," I whispered in my shame. "I was emasculated a long time ago."
"Yes." Her voice was gentle, compassionate. "I was there when they did that to you. I felt the knife as keenly as you did. I wept for you, Taita. But I rejoiced for myself. Coupling is not the same as uniting. I was speaking not of the brief conjoining of the flesh that ends too soon in a puny muscular spasm. Sparse reward for the man who renders up his seed, or for the woman who accepts it into her womb. That is merely nature's expedient for launching another mortal life into a brief and inconsequential existence that too soon is obliterated by death." She guided my right hand down from her lips and thrust my fingers deeply into the crevice between her luscious thighs. It was narrow as my two fingers and lubricious. I felt my own loins melting with the heat of hers. I was not speaking of this. With her fingertips, she gently caressed the brutal scar between my legs where once my manhood had been. "Nor of this. What else is there that joins a man and a woman, Inanna?"
"There is the uniting of souls, rather than bodies, the melding of superior minds. That is the true miracle of existence that can very rarely be consummated." She drew me down onto the greensward of the secret garden. It was silken and soft beneath us as the down of the eider duck. She came over me in a swift and sinuous movement, and at once our bodies were locked as closely and as intimately as the gods had designed them to be. Our legs and our arms were entwined, and our breath was mingling. I could feel her heart beating against my own.
Gradually, our two hearts became a single organ that we shared, and they beat as one. Our combined breathing harmonized and sustained both sets of our lungs. It was the most uplifting and fulfilling sensation I had ever experienced. I wanted to be more deeply engulfed by her body, and to engulf her completely in mine, so that we might become a single organism. Then I suffered a fleeting sense of panic and helplessness as I felt her mind taking control of mine. I tried to prevent it, but then I realized that I was usurping her mind, even as she did the same to me. As she took my memories from me, so I garnered hers. Between us, nothing was lost or forgotten. We were sharing an existence that stretched back into the distant past. "Now I know who my father is," I whispered, hearing the wonder of it in my own voice. "Who is he?" she asked. She knew the answer before she formed the question, and I heard her question, although she had not spoken. "He is Meniotos, the god of anger and morality," I replied, in the divine silence that we shared. "Who then is your mother?" Inanna asked, and I took the answer from the single mind that we shared. "My mother was Celias, but she was a human and mortal. She died giving birth to me." "You are a demigod, Taita. You are neither entirely human nor completely divine. Even though you are a long liver, one day you too must die." She wrapped my soul more tightly and protectively with her own. "It is a day that is still far off. However, I will be there to shield and sustain you when it happens. After you have gone, I will mourn you for 1,000 years. "Who are you, Inanna? Why do I feel so bound to you, in both body and spirit? Who is your father?"
"My father is Hyperion, the god of light.
He is the brother of Meniotos. So we are of the same divine blood, you and I," she answered directly. "I heard your answer before I asked my question," I told her silently. "And your mother, was she a mortal human or a goddess?"
"My mother is Artemis," Inanna replied.
"Artemis is the goddess of the hunt and of all wild animals," I acknowledged. "She is also the virgin goddess and the goddess of maidens. How can she be both a virgin and your natural mother?"
"You must know, Taita, that with those of us who are gods and demigods, all things are possible. My father Hyperion restored my mother's virginity to her the hour after I was born." I smiled at the charming practicality of her father's solution, and I felt Inanna smile with me before she continued, "But I am a virgin like my mother, and by the decree of Zeus, who is the father of all the gods, I must always remain a virgin. That is my punishment for refusing Zeus, who is my grandfather, when he sought to have his incestuous way and copulate with me." "That is a cruel punishment for such a trivial offense," I sympathized with her. "I think not, Taita. I think it is the kindest and sweetest reward. For how otherwise could you and I be lovers through the ages that have passed, and those that are yet to come, and still retain our virginity and purity?"
"How could anyone know our destiny, Inanna? I had not even been born in the remote time about which you are speaking."
"I was there when you were born, Taita. I was there when your manhood was ripped from you, and I wept for you then, although I knew how richly we both would profit from that terrible deed through the millennia."
"You speak of millennia. Will you and I be together for that long, Inanna?"
She did not reply directly to my question. "Although you have been unaware of it, I have followed you closely since the day of your birth. I knew of everything that befell you, every brief joy and every excruciating agony. Why me, Inanna?
Because we are one, Taita. We are of one blood and one breath.
I can keep nothing from you, I conceded. However, I am not virgin as you are. I have been carnally united with other women in my life.
Inanna shook her head sadly. You have known only one woman, Taita.
I was there when it happened. I could have warned you against it, for you paid for that transitory pleasure with the blade of the castrating knife.
I felt her breath in my mouth and her sorrow in my own heart as she went on. I could have spared you the agony, but if I had done so, if I had warned you of the consequences, then you and I would never have been able to couple as we are doing now, in eternal and divine chastity. I thought on what she had said, and then I sighed, as she sighed within me.
It all happened so long ago. I do not remember the girl's face. I do not even remember her name, I admitted.
That is because I have expunged the memory from your mind, she whispered.
If you wish, I can replace it, and you can keep it with you for the next 5,000 years, but it will bring you no joy.
Do you want that?
You know that I do not.
I was renouncing that poor lost soul who had been a slave with me. In our shared misery, we had given each other some little comfort. She had given me love, but she had long ago been swallowed up by the abyss of space and time, and gone where nobody could follow her, not even an emasculated demigod. I surrendered myself to the moment, feasting on the contents of Inanna's mind and memory, even as she feasted on mine. With our bodies and souls interlocked, time was no longer a river rushing breathlessly by. It became a gentle ocean on which we floated together, savouring every moment as though it was a slice of eternity. She bolstered the ramparts of my soul, rendering me immeasurably wiser and invulnerable to evil. Together, we achieved a state of spiritual grace. After an eternity, my soul spoke to hers. I don't want this ever to end, Inanna. I want to remain with you forever. Like this. Then I heard her voice reply from the very depths of my being. You are part of me, Taita, and I am a part of you. But at the same time, we are separate and entire, each to ourselves. We have our own distinct existences, to which we must return. We have our own destinies, which we alone must work out.
Please, don't leave me, I implored her.
I am leaving you now. It is time for me to go. Her voice was no longer commingled with mine.
Will you return to me?
Yes.
Where? I demanded.
Wherever you are.
When, Inanna? When will I see you again?
In a day, a year, or perhaps in 1,000 years. I felt her body unfold to release me from her embrace, and her arms slipped away.
Stay, just a little longer, I implored her.
But she was already gone, and I sat up. I looked around me in bewilderment. I found myself lying on my cot on the terrace of the palace. I jumped up and ran into the main bedchamber. I stopped in the middle of the large room, and stared at the far wall where last I had seen the doorway to the secret garden into which Inanna had flown with me. There was no doorway now. I crossed the floor slowly and began to examine the facing wall minutely, running my fingertips over the surface, seeking the joint between door and jamb. The plasterwork was smooth and uninterrupted. I remembered then what Inanna had said to me. You must know, Taita, that with those of us who are gods and demigods, all things are possible. It seemed that many years had passed since I had last stood on this spot. Was there such a dimension as time
in that far place to which Inanna had transported me. I wondered. Even if there were, perhaps time had remained frozen in this world while I was in the other with her. While I tried to separate reality from fantasy and truth from falsehood, my eyes alighted on the floral display of red roses in the huge bronze amphora that stood in the center of the floor. I crossed to it and examined the blooms on their thorny stems. They were as fresh as when I had last seen them. They could have been renewed many times in my absence. I spoke aloud. Then I looked down. There was a single red blossom lying on the marble slabs. I remembered that I had snapped it off the main stem the previous afternoon to savour its perfume, and then I had dropped it to the floor for the palace servants to clear away. I stooped to pick it up and sniffed the bloom. It was as fragrant as when I last smelled it. And when I examined it more closely, I found that although it had been without water, it was not wilted, but as fresh and crisp as when I had broken it off the stem. Did Inanna and I spend only a single night in that divine embrace, and not a lifetime as I imagined? I wondered. It did not seem possible. I stood bemused, brushing the petals of the red rose against my lips. I heard the doors of the main apartment open, and then muted voices speaking in Egyptian. "Who is that?" I shouted, and one of them replied, "It is I, master." I recognized the voice of Rusty. Moments later he appeared in the doorway of the bedchamber. "Where have you been?" I demanded. "You told me not to awake you until the sun was above the horizon, master," he protested, with ill-concealed indignation. "When did I tell you that?" "Last night, when you dismissed me." So I had been away for only a single night. Then again, perhaps it had never happened. Perhaps all of it had only been a dream. But I desperately hoped not. I was already yearning for my next tryst with Inanna, if, of course, she was real and not a phantom of my mind. Would I ever know the answer to that mystery, phantom or reality, what and who was Inanna? I had forgotten. Please forgive me, Rusty. Of course, master. But it is I who shall apologize to you. Rusty is so easily mollified. He is a lovely man, and I am really very fond of him. However, I reminded him sternly, do not forget that we are leaving Poseidon in 5 days' time. You must be ready to travel again by then. I have already packed most of our possessions into the wagons. I can be ready to march within the hour. Every hour of those last 5 days we spent in Babylon seemed to be filled with frantic activity. There were the last meetings with Nimrod and his council, the signing of accords between our nations, and the arrangements agreed upon for the remainder of the bullion that I had promised him to be collected by Nimrod's minions in Thebes. I was mightily pleased that I would not be present when the promissory bond for 27 larks of silver, which I had signed with the hawk seal, was presented to Pharaoh Tammuz. On top of all this, there was the arrival in Babylon of the emissary that the supreme Minos had sent to Babylon to welcome my mission and travel with us to Crete. He had sailed from Knossos on a flotilla of war galleys with his entourage. He had left the ships in the Sumerian port of Sidon and travelled overland with his entourage to meet me. His name was Toran, which translated from Minoan as the son of the bull. He was a handsome man in the prime of his life, and he travelled in such state as befitted the representative of the richest and most powerful monarch on this earth. King Nimrod set aside an entire wing of the palace to accommodate his entourage. Simply to feed and entertain the Cretan visitors, Nimrod was obliged to spend much of the 3 larks of silver which I had bestowed upon him. He was eager to see Toran return to his island, and did all in his power to hasten his departure. Notwithstanding his physical beauty and regal manners, Toran was one of the shrewdest and most intelligent men I had ever encountered. At our first meeting, we formed a strong bond of mutual respect. Almost immediately each of us recognized the superior qualities of the other. One of the many virtues that we shared was a loathing of the Hyksos barbarians and everything even remotely associated with them. I spent almost an hour commiserating with him on the despicable attack they had made on the Minoan fortress of Tamiat, and the atrocities that they had committed upon the Cretan troops that they had captured there. Torren's youngest son was one of the junior officers whom they had beheaded after he had surrendered to them. However, neither of us mentioned the three great Cretan treasure triremes and the 580 larks of silver bullion that the Hyksos had stolen from the Supreme Minos. It was as though that vast treasure had never existed. I, for one, would readily have sworn before all gods that I had no knowledge of it. What finally convinced me of Torren's superior talents and his advanced intellect was his fluent command of the Egyptian language and the fact that he had read and studied much of my own writing on various subjects. He told me that he considered my treatise on naval warfare and tactics to be a work of genius, and that he had translated much of my poetry into the Minoan language. It was not until the second day of our deliberations that we broached the subject of the proposed alliance between our two mighty nations, and the manner in which we might confirm and consolidate this treaty. These deliberations took another 3 days, during which the two of us tested all our bargaining powers against each other to the utmost, until, on the fourth day, we were able to sign an accord which I had written out in both Egyptian hieroglyphics and Minoan Linear A script. I deemed it was now the propitious time to introduce my princesses to Torren. I invited him and his suite to dine with us the following evening. I personally supervised the selection of the wines and decided on the dishes to be served. My menu was almost as long as the treaty with Crete that I had just signed, but considerably more enthralling. Then I devoted the entire afternoon to preparing my two princesses for the occasion. It was essential for my purpose, not to mention for the benefit of our very Egypt, that Torren should be inveigled into sending a glowing description of all their attributes back to the palace of Knossos. With extreme care, I chose from the huge wardrobe that I had brought from Thebes those materials and colours that best complemented the beauty of my two girls, pink for Bekatha and green for Tahuti. I sat alongside the two beauticians who were applying their makeup. I would not accept anything less than perfection from either of them. By the time I was satisfied with their efforts, I had reduced both of them to tears, but the results were well worth all my persistence. The only beauty I have ever looked upon which exceeded that of my girls on that particular evening was the face of the goddess Inanna in the moonlight. I knew that neither Torren nor his master in Crete would be able to resist my two girls, just as I had never been able to do so. That evening, as I waited until Torren and the rest of the company were seated at the magnificently decorated table that I had prepared, and all of them had been served with wine, before I gave the signal for the girls to make their entrance. When they came gliding in side by side, through double doors at the end of the hall, an immediate and profound silence fell upon the company. The men were held captive with admiration, and the women with envy. My princesses paused in front of Torren, and both of them made a graceful obeisance. They were being followed by Loxias. She also dipped in a curtsy. Of course, I had not lavished any of my attention on the Cretan lass. She was wearing a rather drab little dress that exposed her knees. Her face and her knees were quite pretty, but not exceptionally so. It was obvious that she had attended to her own hair and makeup. She was, after all, a servant, and very fortunate to have been allowed by me to attend the banquet. I glanced sideways at Torren to judge his reaction to this plethora of feminine pulchritude, and I saw he was staring over the heads of my two princesses and that he was smiling. I switched my attention in the same direction as his and saw, to my astonishment and chagrin, that Loxias was shyly smiling back at him. It was then that I recalled her previous admiration for Lord Remrem. I realized that the child must have a penchant for older men. Immediately I moderated my inflated opinion of Torren. He might be a suave and erudite statesman with an elevated taste in literature,
but when it came to women, it was obvious he could not tell a glittering hummingbird from a drab little sparrow. I gestured at my girls to take their places on each side of Toran. They already had my instructions to dazzle him with their command of the Minoan language. Then, with a jerk of my head, I banished Loxias to the far end of the hall, where she was at liberty to exercise her banal charms on some of my junior officers closer to her own age and station in life. Over the next several weeks, I was obliged to spend a great deal of my time in earnest conclave with Toran, Lord Remrem, and the Sumerian High Command, planning and coordinating our joint campaign against King Gorab. The days fled away before us, and it seemed that there was never a moment's respite for me. 2 days before the departure of our caravan from Babylon to the port of Sidon, I could no longer resist the compulsion I felt to make a farewell visit to the Temple of Ishtar. It was my fervent hope that I might find some lingering trace of Inanna within that bizarre building, perhaps a cryptic message from her, or at the very least, an esoteric trace of her presence. I arranged with Onyos, the green-robed priest of the goddess, for him to allow me access to the temple after it was closed to all other worshippers. I went alone, dressed in a hooded grey robe that resembled the one that Inanna always wore. It was an hour after midnight when I reached the wicket door of the temple, where Onyos was waiting for me. I wished to be alone. I dismissed him as I placed a silver memcoin in his palm. He backed away from me respectfully, making a deep and sweeping bow, and disappeared into the shadows of the hippostyle nave. Without the reflection of the great sun mirror in the roof to light it, the temple was a gloomy and eerie place. Except for a very few green-robed priests and priestesses, it was deserted. The stalls, in which the women waited to perform their obligatory service to the goddess, were empty. A few of the more spectacular frescoes were illuminated by oil lamps with polished copper reflectors. The wavering light danced upon the painted figures, imbuing them with a lurid life of their own. I paused before some of them and wondered at the chasm which separated these images from the true nature of the divine and chaste deity to whom they were dedicated. During the voyage of exploration upon which Inanna had taken me, I learned that what men believe about the gods is mostly their own wishful imaginings. The idea that a man can bend the immortals to his will with prayer and sacrifice or pious confession is ludicrous. The immortals do only what suits them best, and that is care for their own power and pleasure. I searched slowly and intently through the cavernous halls and cloisters, but I could not detect even the most tenuous evidence of Inanna's existence in any of them. King Marduk had raised his enormous edifice in an attempt to lure the goddess into it and capture her, but I knew now that the goddess is never the prey. She is the huntress. I climbed the terrace that spiraled up the exterior walls of the temple. This is where she had so often appeared to me, but now there was nothing of her remaining here. I reached the flat roof and sat there beside the gigantic metal mirror that, in the daylight hours, reflected the sun's rays down into the nave. I searched the star-bejeweled vault of the midnight sky above me, but she had left nothing there for me. All I had was my memory of her, and her promise that she would return to me one day.